Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Viewpoints on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel, a new weekly conversation with my colleague Burkhard Varnholt, where we do update you on developments throughout the global market and macro landscape. Burkhard, thank you once again for spending some time with our listeners, our clients on this Friday as we begin to close out yet another trading week. Welcome back. Nice to be with you as always.
Well, thanks for having me, Dan. It's a pleasure.
It is hard to believe we're about to close out the month of April. It is quickly coming to an end. So to reflect a bit, equities seem to have followed the weather with rain and sunshine alternating for much of the month. Now, meanwhile, the biggest moves came from bonds, where yields grinded higher and the Fed did change its stance on the outlook for rate cuts here in 2024. Now, some economists fear that could, in fact, kill growth. I'm curious, Burkhard, to get your viewpoint on that.
Well, do they really kill growth? That is the question I would ask or even push back. It is, of course, widely assumed that high interest rates kill growth. And indeed, back in 1979, that was precisely what the former Fed President Paul Volcker did when he pursued the same rate hiking cycle as Jerome Powell started in March 2022, 2 years ago. Alas, the difference between then and today is that this time around, consumers don't seem to have received the recession memo. To the contrary, they're still doing what they're best at. They shop. And above all, they're spending on services. They travel the world. They invest into their health and well-being. And they spend a lot on all kinds of entertainment like sports, culture, and other things. So, thanks to healthy consumers, plus a lot of deficit finance fiscal stimulus, the economy is still going strong even 2 years after the rate hiking process started. So why aren't real yields more damaging? And now look, some would blame long and variable time lags between rate hikes and the economy. But what puzzles me is that almost none of the businesses or individuals I speak to really complain about a higher cost of capital. And so I challenge that conventional view with an unconventional question. Could higher rates actually stimulate the economy? And let me give you two reasons why I think that may actually be the case. And in particular, in the United States. Number one, service sector companies usually have much less debt than industrial businesses. Their biggest expense are salaries and not interest rates. And that's an important difference to 1979 when Paul Volcker ran the Fed. And it's also an important difference to countries like China or Germany, where industrial businesses represent a much bigger share of the overall economy. But so these service sector businesses like tourism, IT, financial services, logistics, and e-commerce, they're not killed by higher rates. They adjust. And number two to my thinking is this. What many commentators forget is that higher rates, like everything else in life, have two sides to it. Remember that the government surging interest expense, yes, I know it's up from $200 billion 10 years ago to almost $800 billion today, is other people's windfall gain. Especially senior citizens own a lot of treasury bills and bonds. Needless to add that their rising bond incomes create a very tempting windfall gain because it piles on top of record high pension savings. So just a few facts. Baby boomers' net worth today is double of what it was in 2000. It's $76 trillion US dollar. That's an all-time high. Why should these senior citizens tighten their belts when they are, in fact, the wealthiest consumers ever, who've just been benefiting over the last 2 years from unexpected extra income since the Fed started hiking and doing all this deficit funding?
It's interesting. You're essentially saying that as one person's debt service is another person's income, rising rates and growing deficits could actually be a boon, not a curse to the economy, if I understand that correctly. Though I think as well, how relevant is the income effect you mentioned, really? Can it really move the needle here?
Oh, well, I bet you it is moving the needle. Again, let me just mention a few facts here. Non-labor income in the United States is actually 55% of all private household income. So it's even more than labor income. So absolutely, yes, it's very powerful. By the way, back in 1979, it stood at $500 billion and was less than 20% of all income. And consider that since 2010, U.S. private sector interest income has more than doubled, in fact, from $3 to $6.5 trillion. And that's mostly due to the last 2 years of Fed's rate hike, plus other forms of non-labor income like rental, proprietor, and dividend income all grew in tandem, not surprisingly, all increasing the temptation to spend. So, you know, while U.S. fiscal deficits are, of course, unsustainable, we all know that the quadrupling of the government debt service from $200 to almost $800 billion over the past decade must also be understood as a massive windfall profit, especially over the last 2 years, to private households who keep our economy nice and strong.
Now, I want to factor in as well geopolitics. We spoke briefly about this last week. Of course, the other big news throughout the month of April was the escalation of conflict between Israel as well as Iran. Now, what do you think here, Burkhard? Should investors brace for perhaps additional geopolitical challenges? What should they make of what we've seen over the past few weeks?
Well, of course, that's a very, very important question right now. At least for now, it seems that both Israel and Iran seem to apply some restraint in order to avoid an outright war. Having said that, we all know that when a war starts, things rarely move according to plan. So yes, of course, the risk of rising oil, gold, and commodity prices are much higher than they've been for long. And there's even a structural case for the idea of a commodity super cycle, which is to do with big themes like the energy transition or the new global arms race. So we do maintain a positive view on commodities, not only on the back of geopolitics, but also. And what's more, we've just raised our assessment of UK equities. As they do have good momentum, they look relatively cheap as chips, and they're exposed to energy, mining, and defense. And then plus we adjusted global emerging markets back to benchmark because they're kind of vulnerable to rising oil prices, which I mentioned is a concern. And we confirmed our positive view on commodities.
Well, it's helpful to have that guidance when it comes to allocation. So thank you for that, Burkhard. So as we're heading into the weekend, perhaps on the lighter side, not knowing what rain or sunshine April might deliver, do you have any new book or even movie tips for, let's say, a lazy afternoon?
Oh, well, yes, I always do. On a lazy, hazy afternoon, I love to dive into my books and all kinds of lyric when I have little time. I have a very eclectic taste. I like Bob Dylan as much as Robert Frost or William Shakespeare, but maybe one of my all-time favorite poems I should mention here, which I was actually rereading last night, is T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, which is one of the most important poems of the last century. It's big, but it is wonderful. And fittingly, it starts with the words, "April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rays." And so it goes on. It's long, admittedly, but you can find a wonderful recital of the poem by the author himself online, which I can highly recommend. And maybe on a lighter note, my other recommendation would be a re-released movie I watched last week, and I absolutely loved it. It's called Stop Making Sense. So if you ever liked the U.S. band Talking Heads, as I did back in the 1980s, then you absolutely must watch this movie. It dates back to their best concert ever. That was in 1984 in Hollywood. And, you know, it's just been re-engineered and re-released to the movie theaters. I think it's magic. It's a time capsule to 1984. And it's so immersive. It's a pure concert, not a single comment added, no acting, and yet it is fascinating. And that's thanks to the amazing director who later won an Oscar. And it's also thanks to the beautiful choreography, the stage design, David Byrne's unique show and creativity, and the audio quality, which is so immersive. Just been re-released, and well, after I watched it with my wife last weekend, both of us rated it 10 out of 10 points. So here you go.
Well, I've been meaning to watch that myself. David Byrne, Talking Heads, has always been a personal favorite of mine. So thank you for those recommendations, Burkhardt. And as always, thank you for spending some time with our listeners and clients for another episode of Viewpoints here on UBS Market Moves. And do look forward to continuing our conversation with you very soon.
Thank you for having me again, Dan, and enjoy your weekend too. All the best.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.